work. So what I'm going to talk about today is a little bit something a little bit exotic, maybe. Since I'm going to talk about wormholes, so obviously these are fascinating objects, I mean, fascinating topological, because of the topology and the, I mean, time travel and so on and so on. So it's very, very exciting objects. So, but the interesting, so what interests me here is, of course, if these objects really exist, then they have some profound implications. The Cauchy problem, for example, things like this, you know, the non-uniqueness of things like this, the evolution of closed finite curves. So, what I'm interested here, if there is any way, maybe the nature protects us against these objects. And so I'm going to talk about wormholes in some very specific models, but there have been also claims in the literature, maybe you have seen those stable, traversable wormholes. And actually I'm going to show that in some cases one has to be careful sometimes about this claim. So I'm going to show a very simple model, which has been claimed these are stable wormholes, in fact they are unstable. Okay, and then I'm going to say something about some different models. Okay, so this is the plan of the talk, a short introduction. Then I'm going to present you a very simple wormhole model. Then when you talk about stability, then of course you have to say in which theory you're considering stabilities, right? Because the theory, the field equations basically are going to tell you what the dynamics of the fluctuations are going to do, and if a given solution is, or given geometry, say, is stable or unstable, may depend actually on the theory you're considering, okay? So you're going to consider a very simple theory where you have a so-called Gauss scalar field. Okay, then we're going to talk about the linear stability analysis. So we're going to show that they are actually unstable. With respect to linear fluctuations. And then the question is, well, what do they decay to, these wormholes? And for this, we're going to do a nonlinear numerical evolution, and I'm going to present you some results about this. And then, depending on time, we will try to consider put some charges to see if this can stabilize the wormhole and talk about a different model that has been proposed recently also. Okay, so this work has been done mainly in collaborations with other people at the institute I work at, so Jose Antonio Gonzalez, Francisco Guzman, and Thomas Senex. Okay, so what are the wormholes I'm thinking about? So what I'm thinking about here are asymptotically flat solutions of Einstein's field equations, coupled to some matter fields. With space-time topology, so R, so that's in the time direction, cross sigma, where sigma is a three-dimensional Riemann manifold with some non-trivial topology, so not R3, something more, something different. So one example is space-like hypersurface R cross S2. So in this case, you have two asymptotic ends. This would be like a cartoon of an embedding diagram or something like this. So you have basically two universes, this red universe and this red universe and this green universe connected by a float. So the R direction is this one, the S2 direction. And what I'm also going to impose is traversability. So that means that these two universes are in causal contact. So you can travel from one to the other and back with a causal curve, or timeline curve. Okay, and then another example is if you identify the two ends, and you can have a universe with one asymptotic end, whose topology looks something like this, so the space-like sizes look something like this. Okay, and then this has been proposed, such things like interstellar travel, the shortcuts through the wormhole to get from A to B. And also, if you start moving one of the mouth around, then you can construct time machines. Okay, now there are restrictions to have a wormhole, and yes, the solution to Einstein's field equation. And some general argument has been given by Friedmann, Schleich, and Witt in 93, which is called the topological censorship theorem, in which he says that in a globally hyperbolic asymptotically flat space-time, satisfying Einstein's field equation, and the so-called average null energy condition, then every causal curve, which goes from scribe minus to scribe plus, and to past non infinity to future infinity, can be continuously deformed to scribe.
Okay, so what does that mean? What is a scribe?
Yes, so scribes are asymptotically flat. So you have a past non infinity and a future non infinity.
And okay. What is the scribe, the last one?
Well, the last one is basically a union of these two. Okay, so if you have a wormhole, then somehow the curve would be trapped through the throat and you cannot deform it to infinity. Okay, and the null energy condition, what it means, if you take the stress energy tensor and you contract it twice with a null vector, then this has to be larger or equal than zero for all null vectors. Okay, and this is a very weak form of energy conditions. If the null energy condition is violated, then all the other conditions, like the weak energy, the strong energy condition, the dominant energy conditions, they all violate it. Okay, so this is implied by all the other energy conditions. Okay, so that means basically the implication of this theorem is that, at least in general relativity, if you want to construct wormholes, then you need to violate this null energy condition. Okay, so in particular, you violate, for example, weak energy condition, which means that some time-like observers will measure negative energy density.
But you say average null energy condition, so you mean average over the whole universe, or?
Well, yeah, so the average is something even a little bit weaker, so you integrate basically this quantity over non-geodesic, and then this integral has to be positive. On zero. So if the average is violated, then the non-average is also violated. Okay, so that means that if you want to construct wormholes in GEO, then you require exotic matter. So matter fields that violates the null or even the average null energy condition. Okay? So there has been some arguments that have been put forward to support that this might actually be possible. Some dark energy models actually violate the null energy conditions of phantom energy.
So everything is using four dimensions, is it? Or?
Everything is in four dimensions, yes. 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 Okay. So then there are also quantum effects. So for example, there's a paper by Flanagan and Wald where they do some semi-classical considerations. They treat the metric basically classically, but then they look at the quantum field and they allow the background to dynamically react to the quantum field. And then they show that indeed you could, at least in very small regions, you could violate the average null condition. Okay, but so I'm not going to talk or to try to support this argument, so I'm going on the opposite side and say, well, let's assume that exotic matter exists, I mean, that exists somewhere in the universe, and maybe can be produced somehow, and what they want to ask then, are these solutions, or can you construct solutions in some theory with this exotic matter, which is stable? And by stable, I mean with respect to classical dynamical fluctuations. Okay, so just classical, so not going to do anything, not going to quantize anything. So this is just a classical consideration. Okay? And as I said before, so for this, it's important to fix a theory. So we have to say which theory we are talking about, and this theory will then dictate to us how the the fluctuations would behave. Okay, so I'm going to start with a very simple model, which is a low scalar field. So this is basically so the R mu nu. This is a Ricci tensor, so it's the space-time matrix G mu nu. Then this is the gradient of phi. So phi is a real scalar field here, okay, which satisfies the wave equation on this space-time. And the only strange thing here is that this coupling constant k here is negative. So instead of being plus I 8 pi j, it's minus 8 pi by j. And so this has a potential to violate the null energy condition, because if you compute here, if you contract R twice with k, okay, so the Schwarzschild stress equation is basically a stress energy tensor, then you get kappa k mu lambda mu phi squared, okay? And because kappa is negative, then you see that unless the derivative of phi on k is zero, so if it's non-zero, then you violate an energy condition. So this has the potential to create wormhole, and in fact it does.
But even if you don't have a wormhole, generally this is unstable, because you could generate positive energy gravity and negative energy phis, and then that catastrophically basically gets rid of your vacuum.
Yeah, so I'm not sure about this actually. So, you mean at the classical level or the quantum level? So
well,
so
even at the classical level, I think.
Is it an unstable
situation? So you violate the positive mass theorem, yes, but that doesn't mean yet that you can't have solution if it's unstable.
At the linear level, you don't have an instability because I mean gravitons don't couple to a scalar there, but
yeah,
at the non-linear level,
yes,
they would couple.
Yeah, that doesn't clear to me. That's
that's why we don't like ghosts, right?
Yes.
Because if you have positive energy, negative energy particles, then you can catastrophically basically create infinite number of them.
So you would claim that for example Minkowski is unstable here, but I think that's I don't think that's true.
I
think at the linear level, it's not. Even at the
linear
level, I think it's not
a
step. Yeah, I think it is, but.
Okay,
we
should discuss that then.
Yes. So I think it's not that clear that it is. I mean, of course, you have to say what this theory does not in general. Okay, so. So let's consider some static spherical symmetric solutions. Okay, so we make an ansatz for the metric where basically you have two free functions, so A, C, and then you have phi, which is a scalar field, and it's supposed to depend only on some coordinate x. Okay, so x will measure here where you are here in this picture. So we'll see later more precisely what it is, okay? So this e to the c here, this e to the 2c, this is, or e to the c here, this is basically a geometric radius, okay? So against spherical symmetries, we have preferred spheres, so we can measure the area radius. Okay? And we impose asymptotic flatness, so that means e to the a has to go to 1, as x goes to plus or minus infinity. And r squared divided by x squared has to go to 1. And those are the gradient of phi has to go to 0. So these are three required. Okay? And we're going to look for solutions which are everywhere regular for x. Okay? So they don't develop any similarities. And since the solution is known, in fact, so you have a two-parameter family of solutions which was discovered in 73 by Ellis and independently by Hebronikov, it seems. And that's how the solution looks like. So you see the aerial radius here. So if you forget about this term, this is just regular. But if you look at this term, for example, then asymptotically it goes like x squared, as you wanted. And then it has a minimum, that's where x is 0. So it is a b. Okay, so that's the that will be the error radius of the front, basically, right? And phi is just the arc tangent. Okay, well, it looks like there are three parameters, but in fact, one parameter you can have some the redefinition of your coordinates. So in fact, there are only two gauge invariant independent combinations of your parameters. And physically, what they describe to you is that you can measure the ADM mass. Now you have two ADM mass because you can measure them at either end. And it turns out either they are both zero, so this is in the symmetric case, in the reflection symmetric case. So this is when this time the gamma 1 is 0, and both are 0, and otherwise one is positive and the other is negative. You have positive mass at one end and negative mass at the other end. Okay, and then another independent quantity that you can measure is the error radius of the throat. Okay, so if gamma 1 is 0, this is just B, and this gamma 1, basically, this parameter tells you how far you are from the wormhole being reflection symmetric about the front. Okay, and now we want to analyze the linear stability of this object. Okay? And there has been two work in the literature, so both in 2002. So, one by Amanda Ispicon, and he claimed that these wormhole solutions are linearly stable. And you look at the paper and it looks quite reasonable. I mean, he linearizes the field equations and gets a kind of effective Schrödinger equation with positive potential. So you say, yeah, okay, then he's probably right. And then in parallel to this, there was numerical work by Shinkai and Hayward, and they claim that it is unstable. Okay? So they looked at nonlinear perturbations, and what they say that this is a nonlinear effect, which so that the nonlinearities are responsible for the perturbations, but I mean this could in principle happen, but that would be strange somehow. So who is right? Okay.
Did they just do it for the wormhole, or
yes?
I mean, so is it analytic or numerical that's nonlinear?
So this second is numerical work.
Numerical.
Yep.
They didn't try it with Minkowski, for example, or did that?
No, they didn't. No, I don't know.
When they say it's unstable, what does that mean? What is...
Yes, so they start from the static wormhole and add a small perturbation initially. And then they let this initial data evolve. And then they see that the throat, for example, starts to grow or collapses in time. I will say more about this, what happens and what the end state is. Okay, so here you could say, well, maybe what they saw is a numerical instability or something like this. Let's see if it's right. Okay, so what we did first is to check the linear stability. So this is basically how the Ispicon's work. Okay, so we just take the field and we take a curve through this field. So this is a static solution. And then plus lambda plus a small perturbation, where the perturbation now can depend on, can be dynamical. Okay, and we do the same for the metric fields. Okay, so then we linearize the field equations, and we're going to get linear equations for the perturbed quantities, the variation of the quantities. Okay, so when you do this, there's only always something you have to worry about, and these are, you have to check what happens. I mean, you have to be sure that you get rid of your gauge modes. So, of course, you could do an infinitesimal coordinate transformation. You change t and x a little bit, which preserves the form of the metric. And you want to be sure that you somehow cancel out these gauge transformations. And in linearized theory, most of the time you can do it. And the way you do it, you simply check how this perturbed quantity transform. And the gauge transformations and the coordinate transformations. And then what you can do is you can construct linear combinations, okay, gauge invariant linear combinations. So, for example, these two quantities, they are invariant with respect to infinitesimal coordinate transformation. gain the benefit to work with those quantities, you don't have to worry about the agents anymore. Okay, and then you play with the linearized field equations. And then what you notice is that you can write all your linearized equation, you can cast it into a wave-like equation. So psi is basically one of these gauge invariant quantities rescaled. And psi tt, so this is twice the time derivative. And then this is basically a second derivative with respect to x with some potential. Okay, and you look at the potential, and okay, it looks like this. And there's one thing to notice here is that this potential diverges at the front. So, and this is because of this term here. So when x is equal to gamma 1, this is where the front is, this term diverges. Okay? So you have a nice equation here, but you have a potential which diverges. So, I mean, this is not necessarily worrisome, right? I mean, if you look at quantum mechanics, the Schrödinger equation for a central potential, then you also have a 1 over r, a potential which diverges, and still you can, everything is fine. You can compute energy eigenstates and so on. Right, so this alone is not, doesn't mean that this is worthless. However, of course, there is a difference between the quantum mechanical case and this case. In quantum mechanics, you want to have a unitary time evolution. So in other words, you want your Hamiltonian to be self-adjoint, right? And here there is no, I mean, you don't necessarily want to impose unitarity, right? You don't know if it's going to be unitary. Okay, but let's... So let's go on. So let's look at an example. So this reflection symmetry case, where the float is at x is equal to 0. So then this equation simplifies, and the potential looks like this. Okay, and I mean, there is equivalent. So the argument is, well, this potential is positive. So this is stable. So the solutions say they won't have exponentially growing modes, for example.
Okay. So, Jack, in what sense is this the potential?
This is an effective potential. I mean, this is just sort of the linearized field equation.
That's not like Schrödinger equation. Or...
Yeah, it would be a time independent Schrödinger equation if you do a mode analysis. If you replace psi by, you assume it's p to the I omega t, then this is minus omega squared, but this looks like a time independent Schrödinger equation. So that would be the effective potential. Okay? Now, you can do this, and everything is fine. I mean, you can argue this way. However, physically, this the fact that this divergence, like 1 over x squared, imposes a strong constraint on the perturbations. Namely, it means that the perturbations, I mean, in order to the equation make sense, that means that psi has to vanish at x is equal to 0. Okay, because this was like 1 over x squared. So, you know, for this equation to make sense, that this has to happen, okay? So physically what this means is that you can argue like this, but physically what you're doing is like, would be like to put a mirror at the throat. Okay, so that means you have a perturbation coming in from one side of the universe, then it gets to the throat and bounces back. Okay, and so this analysis, what it implies is if you put this mirror at the throat, then the wormhole would be stable. Okay, but clearly that's a very artificial thing to do. I mean, at the throat, nothing is singular at the wormhole. So if you put a little perturbation, the wave packet would travel towards the throat, you expect it just going through and not being totally reflected. Right, so this condition here is too restrictive. So you want to get rid of this condition.
So that was a condition you chose to put on, or you're saying that the analysis of the equation near x equals zero is going to tell me that has to be true?
Yes. So basically, what you could do is you just take the special part, just a Hamiltonian here, and you want to write as a self-adjoint operator. And this forces you to impose this condition here.
So it's analysis of the equation that tells
you. So it's analysis of the equation that tells you.
If you proceeded mindlessly, you would discover you had to get that condition in order to avoid the pathologies of this.
Yeah, so this is to get to have the operator self-adjoint, but there's no reason to have the operator self-adjoint. Yeah. So because you're not in quantum mechanics. Yeah. That's in fact what is going to happen. Okay, and in fact, when you do the simulations, I'm going to talk about simulations later, but just to anticipate a little bit, when you do the simulations, we put a little perturbation outside the wormhole, and actually we see that as long as the perturbation is outside, I mean, as long as it doesn't get to the throat, nothing happens to the wormhole. So when it gets to the throat, that's something that will become unstable. So why is it unstable? So what I'm going to do is transform the equation to a regular equation, to an equation which doesn't have this 1 over x squared singularity in the potential. And there is a nice way of transforming this equation is that, so if I define the Hamiltonian operator, so that's just minus Laplacian, that's the equipotential basically, then there's a nice thing about this Hamiltonian, it has a zero mode. So it means it has a distribution of psi 0, so h of psi 0 is 0. And where, I mean, it looks very complicated, so where does this solution come from? And actually, remember that in the background solution was a many-parameter family of solutions. So there were two parameters. So because we are linearizing the equations here, that means that if we start from one solution, particular solutions have to be static deformations, which just brings you from one value of the parameters to a neighboring values of the parameter for the static solution. Okay, so this basically measures this basically the linear deformation as you go from one static solution to the other one. This is why you have this. Okay, and because you have this, you can define intertwining operators. So it means that you define A this way. So that's a formula joint, A Dagert, in this way. And then you can factorize your Hamiltonian as A Dagert, A. Similarly, like in the harmonic oscillator in quantum mechanics. Right? And then what you can do, you can hit the equation with A. So you go to this dual variable psi, which is A psi. And this satisfies a new equation where now the Hamiltonian, instead of being A Dagert A, is AA Dagert. Okay? And it turns out that AA Dagert is again in this form of a Schrödinger operator, but now the potential is positive. The potential is regular. So it doesn't have any 1 over x squared singularities. Okay? And in fact, this potential is now negative, so it's not everywhere positive. So it has a potential well with a negative minimum. Okay, and furthermore, you can go on with the argument. So I wrote here again the transformed equation. And so this operator again possesses a zero mode, which is now 1 over psi 0. And as long as the wormhole is not reflection symmetric, this is actually normalizable, this mode. Okay, so that means it's L2, I mean square integrable, basically. Okay, and if you look at it, so this is a harmless factor, this 2, but if you look at it, it has exactly 1, 0. This is at the throat, when x is equal to another one. Okay, so in other words, because of you have this nodal theorem in quantum mechanics, and which deals with the ground state, wave function doesn't have zeros, and the first excited state has exactly 1, 0, and so on. So what we found here, this is the first excited state. Okay, but it has zero energy, so that means that the ground state must have negative energy. Okay, but negative energy here, again, because we're not in quantum mechanics, so negative energy minus b squared, that means that we have a solution that grows exponentially in time. So it's e to the beta t times this ground state function here. Okay, and beta is real. So of course you have another which is that, right? But when it grows exponentially, you can eliminate it at some time. Okay, and for the reflection symmetry case, you can. So the problem is that this eigenfunction is not normalizable anymore, so it's not an eigenfunction. But you can still show that you have instability just by applying the Rayleigh-Ritz variation principle. So you just apply test functions and you show that you get a negative eigenvalue for the energy. Okay? And now what you have to check now is that this solution that I wrote down here, so this exponential growing solution, really does give rise to expressions for the gauge invariant quantities, which are regular everywhere, right? Because if they had singularities, then that's not the best argument. It turns out this is the case. So the conclusion is that all this static, spherically symmetric wormhole in this theory are unstable, linearly unstable. Okay, and now you can look at the time scale. So basically, you compute here. You have to compute this beta, so this exponential factor here, and it turns out to be of order of unity. So that's a graph. So that's this factor gamma one, which measures how far your wormhole is from being reflection symmetric, and that's this time scale normalized by the error radius of the static wormhole, and it's of the order of unity. Okay, so in other words, if you translate this in seconds, if you have a wormhole which is 1 kilometer.
Sorry, so gamma one, sorry, yes. Small gamma one is reflection symmetric or big gamma one?
So zero is reflection symmetric.
That's reflection symmetric.
Right, and all the other ones are not.
Okay.
So big
right.
Gamma is.
So it's the most stable when it's reflection symmetric,
yeah.
But it's
yeah.
Still not stable.
And in fact, you can do some kind of asymptotic expansion to look at a large gamma one limit. And so this is a theoretical prediction. And this curve was calculated by numerical finding this eigenvalue. You see it matches, seems to match.
So there have been these papers about trying to build realistic wormholes that astronauts can go through and so on. So. Do you know how to convert that into years or microseconds or whatever?
Yeah, that's the next slide. Also.
Okay.
So if I take a wormhole with error radius 1 kilometer, then the time scale is 5 milliseconds.
So a fast rocket would get you through.
That's the speed of light, right? This is light crossing
yeah.
time, right?
That's
well, it's basically
that's
light crossing time.
Yeah. Okay, so now to the question, well, what happens with this? What do they decay to? Right, unstable. So we start perturbing this a little bit, and then the linear stability analysis tells us that we start to move towards. So to answer this question, then we looked at numerical integration. So we looked at the nonlinear field equation, but still in spherical symmetry. Okay, but now we didn't linearize them. And then you can write the field equation as a system of 1 plus 1 wave equations with some constraints. So what we do, we take as initial data this static configuration, and then we add a Gaussian pulse to it. Basically, now we are careful to do it in such a way that the constraints are satisfied. And so I'm going to show you some results, but the first thing we did, of course, is to check the consistency with the linear stability analysis. So we see that effectively they start to deviate exponentially fast from the static wormhole, and the time scale matches to very good accuracy to the time scale predicted by the perturbation theory. And there are two cases. So either the flow collapses or the flow expands. And mostly I'm going to talk about the collapsing case. So, okay, so this is a result. So this is the error radius versus this x coordinate. So this is the probe is at zero here, so this is for the reflection symmetric case. And so the error rate is initially, it's this black line here. Then you see as time moves, as time goes on, then you see it starts to collapse. Okay, to a value very close to zero. Okay. What we also observe, so in this, when we do this collapse, is a formation of an apparent horizon. So initially there is no apparent horizon, and then suddenly we find one, and this is the error rate of this apparent horizon. Okay, versus this is the Kalman time. And what we see, so this is for different resolutions, so these black lines are very coarse resolutions, so here the code crashed, I think. But then, resolution is increased, and then you see this increased resolution, you get closer and closer to this flat line. So it looks like it's going to some station state.
Sorry, can I?
Yes?
I guess I lost track. Is this an event horizon or apparent horizon on one side of the collapse? I mean, in your asymmetric wormhole,
yes,
you had a positive mass here,
yes,
but you had a negative,
yes,
mass on the other side. So.
Yes. Yeah, I will show you another graph. So, in fact, there are two apparent horizons, so one on either side.
Oh, I see.
But this is this is a reflection symmetric case, so they are basically the same on both sides.
And in the one on either side, when you have the asymmetry, you see one apparent horizon grow and the other one shrink, or anything?
That tell you a sign that you have that asymmetry?
No, I mean, let me come back to this question later. At least I will show you what happens in the reflection symmetry case. I mean, so that I can answer it precisely.
So I'm a little confused from the,
yes,
graph. So there's no apparent horizon, all of a sudden, boom, you've,
right,
got one, but it shrinks.
It shrinks, right. And that's because we have this Gauss scalar field.
So
what's happening?
The ghost is making it shrink.
Right.
So unlike other apparent horizons, if I'm,
right,
trapped too close, if I wait a while, I can get out.
Yeah.
Provided I'm not.
Yeah. Okay, so what we're plotting here are some curves, or some geometric invariant quantities, so which do not depend on the particular coordinates we're using. So one is just the norm of the grade of the scalar field, so this is this L quantity. And the other one, which we call K, is 1 minus the norm squared of the gradient of the error radius. Okay? And what I'm going to try to convince you is that this wormhole collapses to a Schwarzschild black hole. This is an indication only, but for Schwarzschild black hole, of course, phi is zero, so this quantity has to go to zero. And we measure more specifically these quantities on the apparent horizon, so if the apparent horizon converges eventually to the event horizon of the Schwarzschild black hole, then this quantity is zero, in case should go to one. Okay, because this is... because the grade of R is getting null at the horizon of the Schwarzschild black hole. Okay, and this is again the simulation, so with different resolutions. So this is this L parameter for different resolution, and you see it converges to something very close to zero. And then these curves here, the K, this K, invariant for different resolution, and you see it converges to one. And that's a space-time diagram. So this is just Kalman time, and this x, which parameterizes Herschel slice. So this is initially what the float is. These green lines here are the apparent horizon. So you have one universe and the other universe. And these red lines here, so these are outgoing node rays traced backwards in time. Okay, so you see here, we start with a bundle of node rays, and you see they converge very well to this line here. So all of them emanate here from this point, basically. And the same on the other side of the... Okay? So this is an indication that this is the event horizon. So the furthermore you see, at late times this line matches very well with the Lagrange horizon. And these directions here that I have shown, I mean these arrows here are the null directions. So the Lycons, if you want. Okay, so the apparent horizon here, I mean if you stack it up on this tube, then it will be a time-like surface.
You have, even at t equals 0, do you have different points? Or is this just a, you have a point and...
Yeah, so this is... this is a technicality. So at 0, this is at the verge of becoming an apparent horizon.
Okay.
Okay, so this is just another graph to show you now that the same plots but versus error radius. Okay, so the error radius now is not one-to-run relation with the, with the manifold. It's like if I would fold the wormhole at its throat.
So this is both radius.
Sorry, the error radius.
Error radius. Okay.
Yes, okay. So it measures the area of the two things. Yes, and this is just to show you that it seems that both the apparent and the event horizon they shrink in time. And this is, so you violate the second law, but this is because, I mean, you started with some exotic matter field, which doesn't obey energy conditions, so there's no contradiction. But, you know, it was just exactly like an evaporation process.
Can you see the flux ghost particle or ghost field?
Yeah, we didn't do that. This, yes, so they're not precise yet, at least, yeah. I mean, principally, we should be able to do it. Okay, so, so what are the implications of this? Again, the same space-time diagram that I showed you, and now, if you want to throw a boomerang, for example, into the universe, and the boomerang is supposed to come back, and you see that you have restrictions now, right? I mean, if you stand here, I mean, even if you had a photon here traveling along this part of this is an L ray, so part of a photon basically. Now you see it can go back home before as long as it doesn't reach this line. Right, so once it goes over the event horizon, then when it is in this region, then it can either happily remain in the other universe, or if it tries to go back to the other universe, that will remain the way.
So it would be. So it's traversable. So it's just about traversable.
Yeah, so traversable now depends a lot of the perturbation, and I mean, it's traversable up to this point here, but once you cross the event horizon, then that's it.
How wide is this wormhole again in this x coordinate? Like, is there some, like, you got the apparent horizon starting at a point going, verging out there, but x
yes.
is, like, there's some minimal value of x, is there not? I'm trying to.
Yeah, so x basically is related to the, at least initially, to the proper length along the.
Oh, okay.
So, right, so x goes to zero and has negative values.
So when you're at zero, you're right at the throat.
Right. But the error radius is still finite.
Yeah, the aerial radius is finite.
Finite, yes. Okay. Okay, now in the expanding case, we just see that the wormhole starts expanding and it seems to do it at an exponential rate. So this is a fit, an empirical fit to the numerical data, so that the error radius of the throat. This is a proper time of the throat, so it goes like a power law. So we haven't investigated this paradox, so it's just what we observe, and then we just stop the simulation because it's. So this seems to expand forever, but that's what the simulation indicates. However, there is a subtlety that I would like to mention to you is that. If you have a dynamical wormhole, so not a static wormhole, then it might not even be clear to how to define the throat. And this is actually funny. So this is so we did these numerical simulations, and actually this numerical code has different gauge conditions that we can use. So this is the parameter lambda. That may look familiar to Luis. and then for one value of lambda, this is something very close to the harmonic time slice, and then there's another one, which is gamma is equal to 1, which is a different, which will induce a different slicing. And so my colleagues, also I think Jose did a simulation, Paco did a, so Francisco did a simulation if lambda is equal to 0, and this is what he got. So again, this is the error radius versus this x coordinate. So now it expands, so it goes in this direction. And Jose Antonio did the same simulation with exactly the same initial data, but it's different gauge condition. And this is the picture he got. And if you look at the zoom in, so it looks here that there are two frogs. So that at x is equal to 0, the error radius here is actually larger than at these 2 points here. Okay, so what is going on? So we thought that this was a problem with the code for a very long time, but then actually it turns out this is the coordinate effect. So here is again a space-time diagram with the, I think these are Francisco's coordinate, time coordinates, and these red lines here, they would be the t of equal constant slices, but in Jose's time coordinate. Okay, and the green line here are lines of constant r. Okay, so if you look at this line, so what happens is that the slices are just so deformed in Jose's calculations that they cross here 4 times the constant area line. Okay, so this is an effect of the slicing. Okay, that means that maybe it's not that clear, then how to define the float. Okay, so let me quickly talk about...
What are you trying to do in defining the thrones? Why is it important to define exactly?
Yeah, I don't know in this dynamic case. I mean, just a naive definition of taking a space-like slice and looking at the minimum of the error radius, mm-hmm. is just not invariant. It's just not, that's all I'm saying. Mm-hmm.
So. But the topology is all clear.
Yes.
They have a prediction of what the expansion rate is, and because of funny factor, it would be interesting to see if that funny factor can in a way be traced down to the initial setup or the particulars of the problem, but if there is no invariant way of defining it.
So if you had to describe the dynamics of the wormhole, then a natural thing you would think of is to look at the error radius of the throat, uh-huh. at least in spherical symmetry, but if it's dynamic, then it might not be clear.
Yes. So you send in a perturbation, it could collapse or it could blow apart. How do you know what it's going to do?
Yeah, I don't know. So I think Shinkai and Hayward, they looked at this question and they have some energy argument. They look at the initial data and have some.
So it depends on the energy of your perturbation as to whether you get killed or you kill the universe. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Why should you do it? This quantum interest conjecture that affects order moments in quantum fields.
Uh-huh.
So there you have a time scale for violation of these energy. Uh-huh. How violently can you violate the positivity of energy? For how long? And that you have a limit on the time, and that subsequently you get a very much larger positive energy. So those give you time scales for, you know, violation, the creation of throats and things like that. How does your, have you sort of compare your estimates to that?
No, we haven't. So the time scale, the initial time scale, the one for the linear stability, that's what I told you before, I don't know how this compares to these results.
I think we're talking about those are quantum, right?
I'm just curious whether this particular instability that he sees with the time scale
mm-hmm.
has any correlation to that.
Yeah,
so
that gives you
a time scale for
mm-hmm.
how long you can find or create those one.
Mm-hmm.
So these are microscopic, so I mean, mm-hmm. those are microscopic.
Yeah, in principle, you can scale it. I mean, you have yeah. scale freedom, right? You can make the initial float as small as you like. But of course, at some point.
My point is there is no correlation, if I understand your question, that because there is no H bar here, right? In quantum fluctuation, there's an H bar, so.
The question how they compare if you take the same as scale.
So in principle, you can make this a small, I suppose that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at some point, of course, too small, then probably the classical
treatment breaks
down. So I don't know. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about so we have all thought that the result was negative in the sense that this. Instead, we said let's try to push it a little bit further and try to add. so of course, what you could think of, for example, is to add angular momentum to the wormhole to see if maybe this is helping to stabilize the float. And actually, Tonatiuh Matos and Darin Nunez on one side have thought about it, and also Sushkov analysis towards this. Solutions, but of course finding the exact solutions with rotation is maybe not that easy, and then to perturb it, then it's even more difficult. So we decided instead is to keep spherical symmetry because then the calculations are simpler, but to add a charge to these wormholes. Okay, so in fact you can find, so you can generalize these wormhole solutions with, so you just couple the field, the equations to a Maxwell field, it's spherical symmetry, so basically there's no extra complication, and then basically the electromagnetic field is fixed by the geometry. And then you find this whole, now you have a four parameter family of solutions. But interesting, just the thing I meant to mention is that, the result, we didn't find any stable solutions, linearly stable solutions all seem to be linearly unstable. There is a regime, however, which is again, it's a reflection symmetric wormhole. So mu is basically the charge. So for mu is equal to zero, this reduces to the previous solution. And the interesting thing is that when we look now at the perturbation equations, at the time independent Schrodinger equation, we find complex eigenvalues. Okay, so this is the so this is in the complex plane. So beta is a real part, imaginary part, and these are points that we calculated numerically with different methods to be sure that things are consistent. So for small values of mu, where the charge is very small, we recover the previous result. But then, as we increase the charge, suddenly we see that we have eigenfunctions with complex eigenvalues. Okay, and this definitely tells you this operator is not self-adjoint. It cannot be self-adjoint. And it seems that by pushing the charge very to the limit, so the limit would be 1, it seems that we can have the time scale of the instability as small as possible, it seems. But here, so unfortunately here the code starts to break down, and we couldn't push it beyond this limit. So maybe we should use some kind of asymptotic limit. I tried this, doesn't seem to be that simple, but the two interesting things here are this imaginary part that pops up, and the fact that it looks at it, you can make a time scale as large as you want just by adding sufficiently charge. Okay, very quickly, so this is now a completely different model, which has been proposed by Doroshkevich, Hans, Novikov, and Shatsky recently. And what they considered is a model where you have a dust, but with negative density. Okay, so the pressure is zero here, and you have a magnetic charge Q. Okay, and this is a slide. This is basically these are the Stallman-Gondi models for dust collapse, but a little bit modified. And essentially, the field equations here, they boil down on solving a one-dimensional quantum mechanical problem. So it's spherical symmetry, so you have these mass shells, and each shell, which is labeled by, again, this column X, has to satisfy this 1D equation, and the potential is minus mu over r plus q squared over 2r squared, so this comes from the charge, and this is the mass function for the depth, so it's basically the integral over the density of the dust.
Is this dust charged or neutral?
It's neutral. Oh,
so it could be an electric charge, whether it's magnetic or electric.
Yeah, doesn't matter. Yeah, that's right. Okay, and the interesting thing here in the model is that if mu is positive, well, q squared is positive, so you have a potential well here. Okay, so that means that you have equilibrium solutions at the minimum of the well. Okay, and you can compute where this is, and you find again, this is actually just again the Ellis wormhole for the geometry is again this Ellis wormhole for gamma 1.0, the Morris Thorn solution, I mean, wormhole as it's called. Also. Okay, and here you say, okay, that's it, because you're in the minimum of a potential, so you perturb it a little bit, and then you think, and now I have a stable wormhole. Okay, but it turns out that there is an instability at the nonlinear level, and this is due to the to shell crossing singularities. So what happens is that each mass shell, if you perturb it, will oscillate, in this potential well, but the oscillation period will be slightly different for each neighboring shell. Okay, and what this means, what you can prove actually, is that after some finite time, you have a shell crossing singularity. Okay, and then okay, people have some arguments that this might not be such a severe problem, but another thing that will happen, so you can define a quantity mu, which basically measures the geodesic deviation between two neighboring shells, and you can show that these quantities actually start oscillating as with an ever increasing amplitude. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then we come to the conclusion.
Does that mean the kinetic energy of the shells is going up? What exactly is?
No, so the kinetic energy of each shell is confined because you have the potential well, but it's a problem that because of the oscillation period between the neighboring shells, they oscillate with slightly different periods.
Yeah.
So that means that at some time the distance between two particles will be very small, and then suddenly it will be very large.
Why would it suddenly be? I can imagine.
Well, not suddenly.
After
each other. Yeah, for a small time it's okay, but if you look at the.
But you said it's oscillating wildly.
In time, as you. So it's everything starts okay, but when you look at the asymptotic in time, then this separation starts to.
Linear order, it's growing. Is that,
the amplitude is growing linear in time, yes.
But what's the long. If you wait long enough. Are you just seeing two nicely oscillating shells that happen to have got out of phase, or are you seeing something worse than that?
I think it's something worse because the phase, so they're never going to be in phase together. Right? Because each one is periodic, moves periodically, but with a.
But you said they started in phase. You started them off in
they
phase.
They start in phase.
But then they're just out of phase. But is that all? That's the whole effect. It's not. Or is there some sort of dynamical effect where there?
So,
I don't know.
Yeah. So if you measure the norm of the geodesic deviation, so you take two particles on the shell, they each move on a geodesic because it's dust.
Okay.
On one shell or neighboring shells?
You take two neighboring shells.
Two neighboring shells.
Yeah, so two particles,
and then they'll diverge with time.
Right.
So it's not periodic then.
But it's not just that they diverge, so they get closer, and then they.
Well,
I
mean by that is they right. it's more and more and more amplitude.
So it's an oscillation, which growing amplitude.
Why would it grow in
amplitude? Doesn't that suggest that the individual orbits are not periodic themselves? Because the amplitude would saturate somehow.
Yes. So let's see.
you see, it sounds like the negative energy is pushing out the dust shell, pushing itself out more and more. It's gravitationally repulsive.
Is that,
you know,
So what happens is, if you look at the aerial radius, for example, and you look, so it's getting, so you look at the aerial radius as a function of proper time, say. So what will happen is that it will get some...
of the dust shell?
The aerial radius as a function of the label of each dust shell.
Yes.
And this is getting... the derivative of this function is going to diverge.
It's moving faster.
So the aerial radius itself, I think, is finite, but it will be like a jigsaw. We'll have some jigsaw oscillations in it.
Oh. So why isn't that an infinite kinetic energy? At least naively, it sounds like. It sounds like the thing is moving faster.
Because
the
kinetic energy is, so it's a time derivative, not the radial derivative. I mean, not the x derivative. So when I say the kinetic, when I presented this model, and when I have the kinetic energy, when I told you that the kinetic energy was confined, this was for a fixed mass shell.
Yeah.
So it's just a time derivative. So the time derivative is fine, but the radial derivative of this goes crazy.
So I just wanted to say, this happens like in dark matter all the time and nobody cares about it. Because that's the theory of the universe, right? That you always have shell crossing and there is infinite bit of singularities, if you will. But they don't affect anything, basically. So there is no reason to get alarmed about them.
Well, if it's no more than just the shells cross.
They cross sometimes. It's
hard to say exactly whether you're getting
some. But the question is metric stable or not? And that's the thing too. I mean, you have these things happening on a small scales, but is the larger scale thing stable? And like for dark matter, it is.
Uh-huh.
But in this, even though all these things are.
So here we didn't linearize. So this is a result of the nonlinear equation. So this is a nonlinear effect.
And that's right.
So this is not.
So is the geometry relatively stable or not? That's the question.
I would say no, because you have this geometric quantity which measures the geodesic deviation and this goes.
Not in the metric, so.
In the metric, yes.
Is the metric itself stable?
So this depends on the metric, this quantity. So the metric, I mean.
If this happens, the metric is going crazy too.
Yes.
But not just it's not just a gauge effect. Is the curve the rim of.
Yeah, it's a geometric quantity, so I would expect the curvature invariance.
Nothing is pushing this shell.
So it's not just the shell crossing.
It's more than the shell crossing. So this oscillation. So this.
You mean the shell crossing is driving this oscillation in the metric that's going haywire.
Well, I was seeing the opposite way, that this oscillation, a consequence of these oscillations are the shell crosses. But it's something more than the shell crossing.
That's what I meant.
That's what I said.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's okay. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So the conclusion then, so the wormholes, you can construct them as. But the results, at least in this model, from an unstable equilibrium between the gravity's pull, the gravity's attraction, and the repulsion from exotic matter. The time scale, at least in this model that we've looked at, is very small compared to the aerial radius, like in the speed of light. And the numerical simulation suggests that this.
How small did you say it was?
I'm sorry?
How small did you say the instability was?
The light
curve. Well, for, yeah.
Oh, that's not small. Oh, I see. That's of the order of the.
Yeah, so it's yes.
Order one.
Yeah, right.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant it somehow.
One kilometer takes 5 microseconds. I don't know if you were here when you said.
No, I wasn't. But it's just this thing that says compared to the radio. I thought it was.
It's roughly the throat cross, the light crossing time for the throat.
Okay, and with these numerical simulations, and you can see that either it expands or it collapses to some charge in the black hole, and we are in charge, that doesn't seem to have much, at least in this model. Of course, it's a bad news for us.
So, what if you threw in a cosmological constant that would give some vacuum energy? Could it stabilize it at least in one direction?
Yeah, I don't know. So we went to look at asymptotically flat thermals, rather than would presumably be asymptotically.
But we don't live in an asymptotically flat universe,
yes.
Sort of thing.
Yes.
Hubble-sized wormholes.
Well, but I mean, I guess partly, but you wonder if future scientists or engineers could engineer a local vacuum energy to do what you want. If it could stabilize
yes.
it long enough that you get through, then,
yes.
you know, I mean, it would be sort of like, what is it, extreme sports, right?
Yeah.
You just I mean, it seems to me it's thinkable. How much would you need? You know, the vacuum energy stabilize long enough for astronauts to get through and then poof, but then you make another one to get back.
Yes.
Five that you could navigate from.
Yes. Sorry, I don't think there is a topological censorship theorem that one knows. So even it's not even clear whether you need to have negative energy for these.
For a cosmological constant, you mean?
For having. I mean, all these theorems hold for asymptotically flat or at best
yes.
asymptotically EDS. So
yes,
I don't know if there's an equivalent thing for, for positive cosmological constant.
Yes.
I don't know if there's a topological sensation.
I think there are results, but I think I've seen results like Galloway and.
But a vacuum energy with your ghost thing would introduce a new length scale to the problem, and that could change this. Probably not well, it's too good to be true.
But the thing I don't understand is if you start with a stick theory, then you get stick things out of it. And I mean, the starting point, which was the ghost field, I mean, we know, certainly
yes.
quantum mechanically is not well defined.
Yes.
And I claim even classically it's not well defined. But I mean, it's just the idea is that you could have a graviton that emits some of these ghost particles and becomes more energetic, and then that can happen again and again. So,
but not well defined, you mean not stable?
Yeah, that's right. So it's not as stable. Yeah, I think it's even if you don't have wormholes, that's the case. I mean, that's why people don't avoid ghosts. That's the bad thing, right?
Yes, yeah. It would be very surprising if there were not a generic instability.
Yeah.
Well, you'd like to see if there's some general exotic matter, this instability.
Right.
The trouble is to do a simulation, you need a concrete model.
Right.
Yeah. So.
But that's why these more realistic things as looking at quantum fields, which actually do violate the energy conditions. There's work done by, I don't remember the authors, but people who've looked at precisely this question of quantum fields. But even that, the violation has the limits on how much you can violate the energy
yes.
condition. And
Larry Ford is one.
Yeah, Larry
Ford
and Tom Romans
and
Clive.
But I'm saying that there have been people who have actually used it for wormhole models, I think.
Yeah,
I think
Flanagan and Bold also.
Right.
So
to use those to say that even in those cases, you can't really violate the energy conditions sufficiently to have a traversal.
Yes, so I think Flanagan and Wells analysis, they conclude that you could have them, but they would be Planck's theorem. Small, I mean, in some theory.
So have people looked at like a scalar field with non-canonical kinetic terms? Because that's how in cosmology
yeah,
you get
yeah.
and this quantum field you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, not beyond this.
Because they don't have to have ghosts.
Yes.
You can have negative. You can violate energy mm-hmm. conditions, but not necessarily have ghosts.
Yes, yes.
So
you mean this is the whether Lagrange is a function of
dmu phi.
Yeah.
So did you ever just on this shell crossing, blah blah blah. Did you actually check some scale, some curvature scalars or something, and show that they blow up?
So, oh, you mean for this dust model?
The dust, the negative, which exotic dust, I guess you call it.
Yeah, no, not the curvature invariants, yeah. I mean, not the curvature scalars. So I think they should, but I haven't checked it explicitly yet.
But again, that does happen for dark matter as well.
No, I mean, they do, of course.
Because well, when they cross.
Yeah,
I know.
When they cross.
I mean, some
bridges in memory.
But they cross several times. So every time they cross, they have one. But I guess the relevant question is if you have a box or something like this, the box would be.
Yeah, I don't know how to ask it. But you want to say at some coarse grained level that the geometry is going crazy.
Yeah.
So how do you say that?
Yeah, so there are these oscillations, but that's how we checked. I mean even these oscillations are beyond the first time. I mean, this is if you accept the shell crossing singularities, if you're willing to accept them. Let's say they're harmless, then we observe these oscillations. Then we didn't went any further.
Somehow these shells are tapping onto the energy, the negative energy density of the ghost. And
there is no ghost there.
They're negatively.
They are ghosts.
They're themselves ghosts. Right. They're like ghost dust or something.
Okay, so we're going to have to leave the room in 5 minutes. Okay. So Holiday is going to be here till the end of the month, so anyone wants to check.
Thank you.